This is the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. Yara is the global leader in crop nutrition knowledge and the leading producer of quality fertilizer products. The podcast is intended to facilitate the transfer of knowledge for farmers and crop advisors, improving farm profitability and environmental sustainability. With Yara, knowledge grows.
Thanks for joining another edition of the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. We are with Dr. Steve Petrie and his agronomic tip of the week. Last week, we started a series where we talked about soil sampling and getting analysis from the samples that you get from the soil. We talked about how to do a correct soil sample and get a good some good samples out there and then send it to the lab. Now we're going to talk about the lab analysis. So I have my bucket full of soil and I've stirred it up and I've taken a 1 pound sample of that. Where do I send it, Steve? How do I find a lab that's going to be able to give me good information?
Sure, that's an excellent question. And I'm not going to recommend a particular lab. Obviously, the podcast is going to a large number of people mm-hmm. throughout the country, and my focus is in the West, Western U.S. I would say that there's a couple things I look for when I'm thinking about a laboratory analysis, and somebody brings me a sample, and I look at the lab, and okay, do I know if they're a participant in a proficiency testing program? Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of those. There's one run by the Soil Science Society of America that's called the North American Proficiency Testing Program, NAPT. And I know the people that run that program at the administrative level, and they do an excellent job. And that's a very good way to test a lab. There are other proficiency testing programs. The key thing is, does the laboratory participate in an unbiased third-party evaluation of their ability to do good analytical work? And beyond that, then, you'd look at things like, okay, are they certified by agencies to do manure testing or to do other types of analytical results in soils, looking at other agencies other than just nutrients? Well, if they are, then that may be an indication that they do good work with their nutrients as well. On the other hand, the lab may not choose to participate in those types of analytical work. And so the lack of a certification in that area should not be a black eye, but that's one more thing you could take a look at. And then if you have the opportunity to work with a lab for a while, and if you've got a history with a particular laboratory, I would tend to stick with that laboratory. And the reason I do that is that the couple of things that are very important about a soil sample is, number one, taking a representative sample. Mm-hmm. We talked about that in the last podcast. But having a history and knowing, okay, using the same sampling technique sent to the same laboratory, my soil test values are going up or down, or what's the historical trends? And sometimes that's more important than the absolute numbers. Am I mining the soil? Are my nutrient levels declining? Am I building the soil resource through judicious fertilizer use and so forth? Am I building up the resource base and setting the stage for good nutrient availability? So using the same lab, you can track those numbers. People I know, and I've even done it myself, take a sample, split it, mix it well, send it to different laboratories, and you know what? You'll get slightly different numbers from those labs. If you take the same sample and send it to the same lab over a period of 2 weeks and put a different number on it, you'll get slightly different numbers. I don't worry about that. One of the things that's important to remember about soil testing is that it is not given the dirtiness of soil, given the complex chemistry and biology and physical properties in soils, it is not at all surprising that laboratory numbers would vary. Different labs running the same sample or the same sample submitted to the same lab and run over a period of time, they're going to be somewhat different numbers. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Things like soil pH are very exact and are reproducible within a very small percentage of error. If the soil pH comes back in the soil and I get the lab that says it's 6.5, mm-hmm. well, it's probably 6.5 plus or minus about a tenth. So 6.4 to 6.6. And that ought to be true for just about all laboratories and so forth. I mean, that's probably the gold standard for accuracy and precision is the soil pH value. Mm-hmm. Conversely, some of the nutrients are very unreliable, and it's not because the laboratories are anything at fault. It's just that the chemistry in the soil, the biology that goes on in the soil and so forth, certain analyses are inherently way more variable and less reliable than others. And the two that I think about are sulfur and iron. Mm-hmm. And those are the two results that I guess I could say, frankly, that I usually ignore them. When I was running the experiment station, we had laboratory samples. We took every field every year and analyzed them, and sulfur samples would vary dramatically, same field one year to the next. And we'll get into this in a little bit about how to interpret the results, but our soil sample results would be very low, and we would not get a response to sulfur. And a year or two later, we might have a very high soil test sulfur, and we would still get a response in our sulfur trials. And for a variety of reasons, I simply don't place any value, or very much value anyway, on sulfur soil testing. Others do, but that's my professional experience. And the other element is iron. Our soils are full of iron. They have thousands and thousands of pounds of iron. Most of that is not available to plants. It's in forms that can't be taken up. But our soil testing is not a very reliable indicator of whether or not we're going to need to supply iron. For iron, I rely primarily on visual observations, and then to a small extent on plant analysis, although we'll get into this in a future podcast. I don't place much credence in plant testing for iron either. So those are a couple that I have very low confidence in. Other things, the phosphorus content, the potassium content, the cation exchange capacity, all those are going to have some variation in the value. And I would encourage people not to get too hung up if they get a laboratory value of 22 parts per million phosphorus, and the next time it's 20 or 24. I wouldn't worry about those. Those are relatively consistent numbers. Now, if you get 24 once and 9 the next time, then, okay, something went wrong, and I'd spend more time investigating that.
Once you find a lab and you said, okay, this is the lab I'm going to use, and you send the sample there, what kind of analysis do you recommend is run? Or I assume there's different types of analysis giving you different information. We've talked about in all of the nutrient agronomic tips of the week that we talked about how important pH is. So I would assume that is something that you absolutely want to have analyzed. What other things, what kind of tests should we ask for?
Sure. And that's kind of a chicken or the egg question, because you want the analysis, obviously pH on everything. And I look at nitrogen a lot. Mm-hmm. But if we don't have good correlation data for nitrogen, or if we don't use that in our cropping system, if we use other tools, then it's less important. But I usually get a fairly complete analysis, NPK, calcium, magnesium, sulfur, and then the micronutrients. Then, depending on the situation, look at soluble salts. And most labs run soluble salts as part of the basic analysis. It's relatively easy and inexpensive, and so that's usually a part of a standard package. And let me add here, most laboratories have a standard package that they'll run for you. And you may not need all the micronutrients. They may do zinc, iron, manganese, copper, boron, iron, which I just mentioned a moment ago, maybe some additional elements. You may not need those, but they're run as part of a package, and it's actually less expensive for the laboratory to run them all than it is to go in and pick and choose a couple of them. So just they'll run a suite of micronutrients. But then you get into things like, you say, soluble salts, sodium, chloride, other things that may vary depending. And if, you know, if you're in Iowa growing corn, you probably don't worry about the chloride soil test. If you're in a central coast of California, you may need to worry about chloride toxicity. So those you need to pick and choose depending on what is run. Generally, using a local laboratory. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be close physically, but a laboratory that's used to and knows your cropping situation will have a suite of analyses that are appropriate for that crop in that environment. And I just work with them.
Perfect. Now, one of the things that you mentioned earlier, just briefly, I want to dive into that a little bit more. Once the lab does this analysis, and we'll get into the specifics in the next podcast, but does that show the amount of nutrient that is available to the plant?
Scott, that's an excellent question, and it's one that I get asked frequently, and or people will refer to, my soil has X level of plant available nutrient. And that's a reliable statement or an accurate statement for nitrogen and maybe for sulfur, although there's, as I mentioned, there's all sorts of problems with sulfur. But in the case of the other nutrients, phosphorus, potassium, the micronutrients, calcium, magnesium, the soil is analyzed by using an extractant, normally a weak acid can also be a weak base, mm-hmm. which is a certain volume of the extractant is added to a certain mass or volume of soil, and it's then shaken and the sample is collected through filter paper, and it's analyzed for the element, the nutrient in question. We won't get into the details about how the analytical techniques are run because they're different for different nutrients. But a number comes out. The phosphorus comes out at 12, and the potassium comes out at 158 or 430 or whatever it is. Well, the same soil can be analyzed using different extractants, and which will result in different levels of that nutrient being found in that sample. Mm-hmm. Now, the soil hasn't changed, but the extractant or the technique or some other factor has changed. And so the number will be different, but not the amount in the soil. That was the same. And so we, for example, on phosphorus, we look at typically a Bray P1, which is an analytical or an extracting technique, an analytical procedure that's used on acid soils. Now we have Olson's technique, which is a sodium bicarbonate. It's typically used on calcareous or alkaline soils. And they'll give different numbers, even though the soil itself will have the same level of phosphorus, a different analytical technique, different analysis will give different numbers. So we don't want to get hung up on the number. What we have to worry about is not the, quote, plant available, unquote, nutrient in the soil. It's, does the soil have sufficient nutrient, phosphorus, potassium, whatever, to produce our crop? And if it doesn't have enough, how low is it, and how much fertilizer do we need to apply to supply the crop with enough nutrient to produce its genetic yield potential? And so what we're really looking at in soil analysis is not the number, but we're looking at the likelihood of a response to additional nutrient in the form of fertilizer. And if we think about it conceptually, a soil test value that is low, whatever low is for the crop and the nutrient, a soil test that is low is likely, the crop that's grown on that soil is likely to respond to additional nutrient applied as a fertilizer. Not guaranteed. I've seen very low soil tests that didn't respond to nutrients because of other limiting factors. And conversely, a soil test that is high is unlikely to respond or less likely to respond to additional nutrient supplied as fertilizer. But there may be a response even there if we're talking about, for example, a soil that is maybe testing high in phosphorus, but we're planting a crop in the ground when it's very cold, there's very limited phosphorus availability, it's a short season crop, so the crop doesn't have a long time to make up a short-term deficiency in the spring. There may be a response to abandoned phosphorus fertilizer planting, even though the soil test may be high. And so low soil test, there's a high likelihood of a response. High soil test, there's a low likelihood of a response. But I say to people, it's never no response, and it's never 100% response. Mm-hmm. But it is one of the tools and one of the indications that we need to look at those nutrients.
Well, and as you're talking through this, I think that begs the argument that you should be doing probably a combination of soil and tissue analysis. The soil analysis may show you that you are high in certain or adequate in some nutrients, but it's not plant available. And so when you do the tissue sample, you'll find that it is deficient. So I think that it's kind of a combination, right? Is that
absolutely perfect point, Scott, that we can have, for whatever reason, we could have a soil test which indicated high in certain nutrients, and for whatever reason, the crop wasn't taking those up. Maybe there was a low level of root disease, or there was some nematode injury, or the soil was extremely cold, the crop was simply not as able to take up the nutrient. Those situations, then we look at the plant analysis, and it can say, hey, you know what, there's some in the soil. The soil test says there's a high level of nutrient, but I'm hungry. You know, the phosphorus in my tissue is low. I need some additional supplemental phosphorus application. And so the two, soil sampling and analysis and an interpretation of the results, provides a predictive tool, but then we can use plant analysis to tell us if that predictive tool has accurately predicted whether or not there was adequate amounts of whatever nutrient we're worrying about is being taken up by the plant. Hmm. And the two together are much better than either one alone.
Yeah. You know, what should be the expectation of turnaround? Is it a couple days? Is it a couple months? What should we expect from a lab?
Typically, a lab will be able to turn a sample within a day or two.
Okay.
Now, there are some analysis which take longer. There are some incubation studies in which the actual time the soil has to be in the laboratory and to allow for biology to take place is sometimes a week. And so by saying overnight or the next day or 2 days, that's a general number for a lab at a normal turnaround time. If for some reason there's a large number of samples, it may add a day or two to that. But most of the labs I work with, if I get them a sample by 5 o'clock, they'll have a number back to me by the next day, late in the afternoon or the day after that in the morning. But you know, the samples, the labs get busy times of the year. They get thousands of samples. They have to dry that sample because they have to weigh the sample, and that's based on dry soil. And the procedures are all based on dry soils. And they have to process the sample. They have to do the analytical process. They have to correlate and do the quality assurance, quality control. All this has to be done. They have to get the lumber number, put it into a database, and send it out to you electronically or whatever, however you get your sample results back. And so 24-hour turnaround still amazes me. When I know how much work goes into yeah. their end of the process, I'm amazed that I can take a sample and put it in a drop box at a laboratory at 4 in the afternoon and get a number the next day in the afternoon.
Yeah,
having worked part of my career in soil labs and so forth, I'm amazed at that process. There's a lot, very expensive machinery, equipment, instruments are used in the soil analysis labs, and the quick turnaround is a testament to their hard work and night crews and that kind of stuff during the busy season.
You know, as you're talking about that, it just a question popped into my head, and we didn't talk about this on last week's podcast when taking the sample. And maybe there's different procedures for different labs, but how do I deliver that soil sample? Is it as easy as putting it in a Ziploc bag or a paper bag, or do I have to put it in a airtight container? What's the preferred method there?
Well, and I'm going to give you kind of a waffling answer because it depends.
Okay,
if you can get it to the lab. And a lot of labs I know have a Dropbox locations throughout, you know, half a dozen of them around their region or mm-hmm. more. And if you can get a sample there by 5, they'll pick it up at 6 and take it and dry it overnight, run the sample, and send you the results. If you can do that, frankly, whether the sample is dry or wet probably doesn't matter because they're going to get a hold of it so quickly. On the other hand, if it's going to be mailed,
mm-hmm.
and I have used laboratories where I had to mail the sample. In a situation like that, if you have a moist soil sample, the biology which releases nitrogen from unavailable to available forms is going to be happening in that sample after the time I collect it. And the sample, if there's multiple days, if there's, you know, 2 or 3 days in the shipping, those can skew the results.
Right.
And so you need to find, you know, I can't say it's okay to do it there in that situation. Then dry the sample to air dry before it's submitted so that this air drying process stops the biology in the soil. And then the laboratory re-wets it and does the analysis and can give me a more accurate number. Again, there are some incubation studies, incubation tests that take 3 days or 5 or 7 days and work with the individual lab to find out how they want you to handle that sample on those.
Yeah, I think that's what I was going to say. It's probably a good practice is once you find the lab you're going to use is ask them what their process and requirements are, right?
Yep. Now, there, and we've been talking about soil sampling analysis and so forth using what I would consider to be conventional soil testing, mm-hmm. where a sample is collected, the soil is small volume, it is treated with an extractant, and the nutrient or the element is measured in that extractant liquid. There are other techniques. There's use of resin beds and resin bags and so forth, which are very proprietary. And those use some different analytical techniques, different sampling techniques, and so forth. And so I'm not going to spend any time talking about those because those are proprietary, and I want to talk generically here about soil testing. Some of those, in my experience, can be very accurate, potentially more accurate and more predictive, a better predictive tool than a conventional soil test. Others of them don't work very well. In some soils do work in other soil tests. And we have a whole host of biology tests that are under development and in various stages of commercialization. And those are also very proprietary. And so in those cases, I would work with the individual laboratory, both on the collection, but also the interpretation of those results, because in many cases, there's not public databases that are available. Can be very good tests, but you just have to work with the laboratory on those.
Yeah, good. If you have questions about laboratories and where to go, go to your retail agronomists and have them make some recommendations. I'm sure they have a lot of experience there. Grab a Yara agronomist. They'd be willing to share some information. The next podcast next week, we're going to get to where the rubber meets the road. The lab analysis has been done. You've gotten the results back. Now what do you do? So pay close attention to next week's podcast.
You've been listening to the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. For more information about our company, please visit us at www.yara.com or yara.us, or for Canada, yaracanada.ca.